On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about what is going on in Ukraine, from the financial position, from the war crimes possibilities, even from banning sports. We'll get into all of it. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Amidst everything else that has been going on, and heaven knows, everything has been going on, and I'm sure you have been following things really closely. Most people have. This is just such a scary and disconcerting and upsetting thing that we've been seeing. We learned this week that the International Criminal Court says it's going to be launching an investigation into whether Russia has committed war crimes against Ukraine. And I know some of you are saying, well, that's a stupid comment. Of course they've committed war crimes. Have you been watching the news? The whole invasion of Ukraine is a war crime. Well, maybe. There are acts of war and there are war crimes. I don't know that the two automatically conflate. I want to bring in George P. Fletcher. He is a professor of jurisprudence. He's recognized as one of the leading scholars on the issue of international criminal law. He joins us now. Thank you so much for the time today.
Yes. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Well, I wonder if you can tell me. I mean, the first thing, as I say, when people say, well, of course Russia has committed war crimes with what they've done just by going into Ukraine, what is the difference between an act of war and a war crime? Or is there a difference?
Well, actually, entering the act of aggression, arguably the invasion of Ukraine is a war crime of aggression. That's possible. It's possible to construe that, in which case there is some difficulty in determining who's responsible. Certainly Putin would be responsible, and the high command of Soviet Army would be responsible. But in addition, there are problems that are related to the bombing. Now, you see, the military targets are all civilian targets, and the attack of civilians is obviously and the most dramatic war crime. This is they could conceivably argue that there is a military objective, but it's hard to see what the military objective is.
What would you have to prove, though, to get this? And again, you look at this and you say, well, it's obvious. They blew up a building. They blew up a square today, Freedom Square, or the Holocaust Memorial and you know, apartments and stuff. And that sounds easy. But is it as easy as that? Or do you have to prove, A, that Putin gave the go-ahead to do it and it wasn't a mistake, and B, that was the intention and they knew it wasn't, and in fact, those videos are not doctored? I mean, it sounds a little more complicated when you get down into it.
Sure. I mean, I think you have to distinguish here between the substantive question and the procedural issue of actually getting a Soviet official before the International Criminal Court. I think that's impossible. I can talk about that, the difficulty of actually arresting somebody and putting him on trial. But for purposes of political discussion, it's useful to address the question whether there have been war crimes that have been committed either by the act of aggression or by the bombing of civilian targets. Now, what was your question again about the civilian targets?
Well, just, I mean, how difficult would it be to prove that was identified by Putin? I mean, can you put the blame directly on him, or is it guilt by inference that, well, he ordered the strikes and the strike hit a civilian target, therefore he is guilty?
No, he would be, he's responsible for the military high command. So I think that's fairly easy to demonstrate.
Let's go to that other point you said, though, which I think is so interesting here, because the International Criminal Court is going to, they say, that, as I say, they're going to do this. But I do almost wonder at a certain point about why, and I get the visual side of this, but as you say, it seems like it would be almost impossible to arrest Vladimir Putin and put him on trial. How would you possibly do that?
You couldn't do it. I think it would be impossible. But I mean, that's nothing new. I mean, it's frequently been the case that the ICC is very important for purposes of political discussion, but that in practice, very few cases have actually been brought. That I'm not downplaying the importance of the Rome Statute and the principles of international criminal law in this context, but in fact, there's been a lot more talk than there has been action.
I mean, essentially, his own army, his own security would have to turn him in. That seems to be about the only way you would ever get your hands on him.
I think that's probably right, yeah. I think
we did see...
Now, it's possible. It's not... I mean, the possibility of junior officials abandoning Putin in all of this, that's a very intriguing possibility, and it could conceivably happen.
Because they look at this and say, I don't want to spend the rest of my life being pursued as a war criminal, so I'm going to get out of this now?
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that that's possible. But again, I think that it's unlikely to happen in our lifetime.
Mm. Could you see any of those junior people being snatched up and put on trial? Or is it even that seems unlikely because you're going to just create hostilities?
No, I think that's also possible. I mean, in all of these, if you look at the history of war crimes trials going back to Nuremberg and the Tokyo tribunals, there's always a problem of who is it better to try? Is it better to try the high officials or the soldiers who, in fact, commit the war crimes? Hmm. And for political purposes, there's a tendency to pick the high officials because they stand for more, they represent a better purpose, a better fine for purposes of propaganda.
It's my understanding that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, there's another group, but the International Criminal Court goes after individuals for this, right? There's another group that could after broader countries. So, so could Russia be penalized in a more broad sense for Putin's crimes under a tribunal or something? Can that happen?
No. I mean, no, I don't think so. Now, of course, there are all kinds of, it's a political matter, there are all kinds of sanctions that are being
used against
Russia. But Russia as a country would not be liable under this Rome Statute. Now, so, I mean, that's not to say that Russia as a country wouldn't be responsible under more traditional views of international law. Originally, international law was based upon states and nations, and it's only... And since 1998, with the Rome Statute, that individuals have been officially held accountable.
We have to run, but in the last couple of days, I just wanted to ask you really quickly before we go, because in the last couple of days, at the United Nations yesterday, and certainly other places we've seen it today, there have been a number of people who have been, have been very clearly calling on Putin to kill himself rather than take the world down with him in this way. Do you think that's a message to some of his people as well, that we would support someone doing something to that guy? That the world wouldn't come after you if you were to take matters into your own hands?
I think this is, I actually haven't heard those arguments, but that someone should assassinate Putin.
Well, we've heard that, but we've also heard at the United Nations yesterday, the Ukrainian ambassador said to him through his speech, he says, look, what happened in the bunker in 1945, that's what you should be doing. Basically, do what Hitler did and kill yourself.
That is a historical matter. That's quite an interesting question, whether I don't actually believe that Hitler did kill himself. But that's a general view about that matter. But I think that's a silly suggestion. There's absolutely nothing that makes Putin desperate. He's not losing anything.
Right.
There's no reason why. I mean, what possible reason would he have for that?
No,
and
what I was thinking was more along the lines of it's a message to maybe those around him that the world wouldn't mind if one of you did something. We're not gonna, this is an idea. We're planting ideas here that one of you may want to do something to help the world.
I see. Well, that's conceivable. But I don't think that... It's one of the things that's difficult to determine under this context is how much loyalty Putin has in the armed Soviet and the Russian armed services. I just don't know the answer. Because he's a former KGB agent, he knows the major insiders. But then there are other groups in Russia today, the oligarchs, who have their own interests.
Yes,
and it's
very
clear that they're suffering the current regime.
It's something I wish. I wish we had more time to talk, George. I apologize for cutting in because I really wish we had more time to talk about this. It's a fascinating topic, and I know that this will be coming up again because they are investigating. George P. Fletcher from Columbia Law School. Thank you so much for the time today.
Nice to talk to you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The sanctions against Russia. This is an interesting way the world is trying to deal with an untenable situation. But the challenge with this is there will be a lot of people, a lot of Russians who will be collateral damage in this, you would think. I want to bring in Marvin Ryder from the DeGroot School of Business. Marvin, thank you for the time today. Always appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Scott.
So we are hearing that the ruble has basically collapsed and there's a run on banks and pretty much everything in Russia has gone economically down the tubes in the last few days. What happens if the Russian economy completely collapses?
Well, thank you for the question. I actually think that's a better question to ask Vladimir Putin. This invasion.
I'm not comparing the two of you.
Well, you probably couldn't get him tonight, so I'll try to substitute as best I could. You know, this invasion into Ukraine has been planned for the last 2 or 3 weeks, maybe even 2 or 3 months. And I have to believe Mr. Putin is not a stupid man. He's not an impulsive man. Say, compare him to Kim Jong-un, who might do something just off the top of his head. I think Vladimir is more of a chess player. And so he had to know that if he was going to invade Ukraine without really significant provocation, the world was going to respond. And this is different than, say, when Hitler rolled into the Sudetenland. We've now have these economic weapons, if you will, that we can deploy. I have to believe that Mr. Putin believed this was going to be a fast war. I'm going to say, for instance, a 3-day war. I'll just drive the tanks in from Belarus. We'll be in Kiev in an hour. We'll blow a few things around. Maybe we'll kill a leader. We'll install a puppet, and everything will be back to normal. I just don't think he thought it was going to take this long. And therefore, these sanctions, perhaps deeper than he expected and faster acting than he had expected. Now, you mentioned collateral damage. War has lots of collateral damage. You know, we know there are, for instance, civilians in Ukraine have been killed. The damage in Europe is more in Russia is more economic than people dying. Yes, the ruble fell. Now, just to put it in context, it was trading at about 1.3 cents U.S., and now it's trading at 0.9 cents U.S. Not a big difference to you and I, but that does represent nearly a 40% drop in the currency. And what does that mean for the Russian people? Well, if they have to buy any imported products, it's going to make them a lot more expensive. So cell phone technology, video games, televisions, those sorts of things are more expensive. Same thing if businesses in Russia have to buy goods from outside, it's going to get harder. And then we deployed something else that most people don't know about called SWIFT. And SWIFT, S-W-I-F-T, is a financial transaction protocol, if you will, that allows banks in one country to process transactions in another country, and they do it quickly and seamlessly, all in just matters of milliseconds. Well, what we have done, what the Western world has done, is said to Mr. Putin, not so fast, we're not going to let you do that. Your banks are now isolated, and any money that you or the billionaires in Russia or just ordinary people in Russia, any money you have outside the country is pretty much sealed off from you because you won't be able to get it not being part of SWIFT. So to your general question at the start is there any route in which Vladimir will say, okay, I've miscalculated here. These peace talks, which to me so far have been more of a sham than a reality, is there a route? And for Ukraine, is there a route? For instance, there are these two, they call them breakaway republics. They're really nothing more than a couple of large counties on the east side of Ukraine. Maybe if they joined with Russia, would that make everybody happy? I don't know. And so I don't know what the plan B or C is. And I'll say one more thing, and then I'll give you a chance to get in. The other thing that worries me about this is he's been fighting this battle with fairly conventional weapons, meaning tanks and those personal armored vehicles. I've not seen either Air Force scrambled in any significant way. And then, of course, Mr. Putin has put his nuclear forces on high alert. you know, where could this go? This is the really the question for everybody. We'd like it to stop sooner rather than later, but I just don't know what in his mind are those conditions.
But if we're seeing that the Russian economy is being hit hard by this, and there's concern, I use the word collapse, there's concern of whatever, is this the kind of thing, does the economy rebound? Let's say Putin goes away, let's say something happens, let's say he pulls back, let's say whatever, mm-hmm. the rest of the world says, okay, we can lift the sanctions now. If the economy has been battered the way it apparently has, does this immediately begin to recover and everything gets back to normal relatively quickly, or is like permanent damage to the Russian economy happening here?
No, at this point, I don't think that anything is permanent. I think this is all temporary damage to the economy. This is a bit, Scott, and forgive me for blending stories on you, but today Stats Canada released data about the December GDP numbers. Remember, Omicron was discovered at the end of November. We did various shutdowns. We wondered what was going to happen. Turned out the month of December, nothing happened with the GDP. It didn't go up any. It didn't go down any. It stayed constant. And we ended the year with 4.6% growth after losing 5.4% the year before. What we found in Canada with COVID, when you took all those restrictions off, we bounced back pretty nicely. And I think this would also be true of the Russian economy. If tomorrow I waved a magic wand and made all of the restrictions go away, then yeah, I think they could bounce back. Nothing really damaging has been done at this point. But this, again, is a war of attrition. You know, if this were to go on for 2 months, if this were to go on for 2 years, then I'm not so sure I would be so glib at saying, yeah, they'd bounce back. The longer this goes on, the more permanent the damage. But this is just day six of the battle.
One more thing. If Russia can't import goods right now because it's costing them so much, because their dollar, their ruble has dropped, that means that countries that would sell to them will also be losing that market. Could that affect those countries then, because they've lost money? Could that affect their ability to buy our goods that we send to them? In other words, could economic sanctions actually trickle down to us in some way?
Well, again, I'm going to say yes, but probably not in the way you're imagining. You know, Russia does some trading with other countries. That's absolutely correct. On one hand, both Russia and Ukraine are considered to be breadbasket nations, meaning they grow lots of different kinds of grain, which are sold to other economies. If they're in war and they can't sell that kind of grain, I wonder what other country in the world is a breadbasket country. Hey, how about Canada? This is actually good news for us. Oil today shot up to $105 a barrel. That's not good for you and I at the pumps, but Canada, half of the stocks traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange are connected to the petroleum industry. Oil at $105 a barrel is, again, also good news for Canada. That's why our stock markets, although they did go down today about 70 points, nothing compared to what happened in the United States. So we're seeing some good news in here. Now, the one more quick thing. There was a big vote last week at the Security Council. No surprise, Russia, a permanent member of the Security Council, vetoed this sanction against them. But there were three nations that abstained. I want you to see if you see a pattern here. China, India, and the United Arab Emirates. Well, China and India are the two most populated nations in the world, and neither of them have joined in with sanctions against Russia. Is it possible that Putin has some backdoor deal with these countries as a way to do trading or a way to get money moving in some way? Is China going to try to emerge as some kind of a hero in this? Maybe they're going to try to broker a peace and sort of shake up that triad. And then the United Arab Emirates, of course, they're an oil-producing group of countries. Are they going to be involved in all this? So, you know, the more days that go by, we're going to see some other patterns, other motivations begin to emerge.
You know, we got to run, but you mentioned petroleum. Boy, if only we had pipelines that we could get more oil to those countries overseas. But, you know, that's a discussion for another day, I suppose. But
yeah, we can't do it by train car, but maybe there are some boats sitting idle that we could fill up with a couple of million tons of oil. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? Marvin Ryder from the DeGroote School of Business. Thanks, as always, for the time.
Glad to be with you, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
All right, I want to bring in a very familiar voice to talk about something else that has been going on in the world and with Ukraine and everything else for the last number of days. Mark Hebscher, everyone knows Mark Hebscher around here, from way back in the day as the host of Sportsline on Global, and then from all kinds of stuff on CHCH, and now as the guy behind Hebsy on Sports, a podcast that you can find on, well, you can find it where all good podcasts are findable, I guess, is the answer to that one. Mark Hebscher, thanks for doing this. Thanks for joining in.
Sure, Scott, anytime. You know that, my friend.
Well, I, you know what? I appreciate you doing this. And I want to ask you, because I thought, you know, I want to bring someone in here who has been in sports for a long time, who has seen a lot of stuff. And I mean, you have seen a lot of stuff in the world of sports. And when we heard that that FIFA, the governing body of soccer, was saying to Russia, you are now out. And when UEFA, the European soccer governing body, said to Russia, you are out. And when the IIHF, the International Ice Hockey Federation, said to Russia, you're out. And when the IOC, the Olympic group, said to Russia, or said, we don't encourage anyone to bring Russia in. And when the World Junior Tournament was taken away from Russia, and when Formula One was taken away from Russia and all this stuff, I thought, does it really matter? They're in a war. Do they really care about this stuff? And then, Mark, I thought a little more about it. And I thought, you know what? There's lots of evidence based on what we've seen over the years that this kind of stuff really, really, really does matter to Russia. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do, absolutely. I think that if you look back, I mean, upon history, you know, what look what happened with the German people after World War One, where they had to go and, what's the word I'm thinking of, Scott? They had to make amends for the, you know, the
reparations
they had caused. Reparations, thank you. And so the German people were down on themselves. They didn't feel as if they were a worthy nation. There was no leadership. There was no, you know, they felt horrible. They were embarrassed. And will the Russian people feel this way? And is that enough to, you know, stop the war? I don't know enough about it, but I can tell you that everyone that I know that I've spoken to of Russian descent is worried. They're worried probably along the same lines as Muslims were when the Twin Towers were attacked, I guess.
Yeah.
And now if you happen to be a hockey player or an athlete or an entertainer or whatever, and someone says, wait a minute, you're Russian. Alex Ovechkin, you're Russian. And you publicly supported Putin. So that's different than, I don't know, you know, a guy playing junior hockey who happens to be from Russia, and his family's worried that he's not going to be able to return home, or he's going to be conscripted into the army, or I have no idea. But I think that overall, if you look at it, I mean, the world's going to say, listen, this is, you know, you know, nations have to unite and denounce Russia. They just have to. And if that means, you know, supplying arms or actual troops, you know, that's another step. But not recognizing them as a member group in any group of ownership. It's like, wait a minute, you know, you got to go by the international rule of law, number one. And if you're not willing to follow the international rule of law, how can you possibly follow the laws of the governing body of sport? And of course, Russia already has a terrible history when it comes to that. Horrible.
Well, and Mark, that's part of the reason why when I first saw this and I first heard about these, my initial reaction, my gut reaction right off the bat was, well, this doesn't really matter. And then what you just said, I mean, Russia spent $51 billion to build up the Sochi village in Sochi for the Olympics. Russia is the country that ran the organized, institutionalized doping program that no one else that we know of has done. Clearly, sports and winning on the national stage and on the world stage, clearly that has value to this, to Putin and to his group that is running the things, to his regime. Clearly that kind of athletic achievement matters in some way to him. They've done all kinds of things to prove that.
Right. And so if you look at it that way, what do you do if you are, you know, the member nations, member countries of an organized world sporting event? You denounce Russia. Now, Scott, listen, I covered the 1980 Winter Olympic Games in Lake Placid, New York, and was supposed to cover the 1980 Summer Olympic Games in Moscow. But, you know, as we know, the Americans, you know, denounced the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. And many nations did, but many nations did not. They went on and competed, including Great Britain, in the Olympics in 1980. There's many, many occasions over the years of countries fighting over
what one thought was the right thing to do and one didn't. You know, the banning of South African athletes. I mean, it goes way back. And this is where, like, you know, as fans, we just want to see the best competition. We really do. But we can't help it when someone refers to someone else as a member of that country. If someone says, well, that the Canadian, Alphonso Davies. Well, we're proud of Alphonso Davies. If Canada was in a war zone, I'm not so sure Alphonso Davies would be that popular a player.
Yeah, what about individual athletes? You mentioned Alex Ovechkin, and he's a really interesting case because you're right. He has been in the past supportive or at least positive towards Vladimir Putin. Not every Russian athlete has, but he has. He's appeared with him. He's talked nicely, and maybe that's not even a strong enough word about him. So what should the expectation be? Should Alex Ovechkin be paying a price, or do you say, I don't know that we can expect that from Russian athletes because they've got family still back there who could be harmed by this. What do we expect from Russian athletes? I don't know.
You know, I had not thought of that until you asked that question. My expectations of Russian athletes, I think, first and foremost, they're human beings and they care about their families. If they live in a world where they're being intimidated, that's kind of not my... I mean, I can't take on the responsibilities of every single human being that happens to live in a country other than where they were born and raised and have family, right? So morally, of course, you want to ensure. But I mean, I don't know. I hate to say this, but I mean, if the person is making millions and millions of dollars and is a citizen of another country or a resident of another country and such a, you know, it's easy for me to say, like, I'm sorry, but, you know, move your family to America or wherever, or you know, you're not the only person that has issues with that. Well, that's a tough one. So do I feel, you know, sympathy for them? I guess I do for anyone, but I really feel sympathy for the refugees, the actual people that are fighting, you know, for their country, for Ukraine. Those are the people. So my heroes are Zelensky and Klitschko, for gosh sakes. I mean,
yeah.
These guys are willing to take up arms to say they're not leaving the country. They're not getting out of Ukraine. They're like, you know, standing strong and doing humane things, like calling the parents of these Russian soldiers who were conscripted and saying, by the way, we've got your kid here and he's captive here in Ukraine. Like, holy cow, that's just, you know, unfathomable. But at the same time, listen, sports goes on, right? It's got, we just went through a pandemic. We're still kind of going through it, but now, you know, sports has got to go on. And if the Russian Grand Prix can't be run, well, F1 will find another venue. They'll figure out a way.
Oh, it will. It will. And I love that you mentioned Klitschko. I don't know if people know about this. The two Klitschko brothers, who were both heavyweight champion at one time, boxers, and both are multimillionaires, both could easily flee Ukraine and live quite comfortably somewhere else in the world. And both are now wearing fatigues and are on the streets of Ukraine. One is the mayor of Kyiv, and the other one is there too. And like... you're right. I am amazed by this. Dmitry Kristich, former NHL player, he says he's over there on the streets right now. There's a soccer goalie from Guelph, who's just gone over there to fight in the streets. Like, it's amazing to me. And again, I go back to something like Alex Ovechkin, and I think if you've got guys who are willing to pick up arms and fight and die, probably. I mean, Klitschko... Would it be shocking if the Klitschkos were killed in this with what we're hearing? No, unfortunately.
They're being targeted.
Yeah. If you're willing to do that, should someone like Alex Ovechkin, who is a role model and a huge spokesman for Russia, and I hate to keep picking on Alex Ovechkin, but should he be taking a stronger stand against Putin? I don't know if that's a fair thing to put on that guy, but boy, the dichotomy of the two, of the Klitschkos being so brave and Ovechkin kind of humming and hawing, really stands out.
There's only one thing Ovechkin can do in that. He has to, he doesn't denounce Putin necessarily. I mean, he has to say, stop the war. And that's about as direct as you can be without being, you know, direct to Putin. He's telling the Russian forces, stop the war. Now, does that mean he's marching for peace? Is he going to, okay. That I would like to see. That I think would be a very brave move by Ovechkin, but, you know, is it the right move? Is that for me to say? I don't know. That's, you know, it's in just everyday life. Just some of the footage I saw today, Scott, of the Ukrainian people standing on a roadway and not allowing Russian trucks and tanks to come through. Like standing there, like, and Russian trucks are like trying to knock them off. Like they're lurching forward. And then more and more Ukrainian people are getting in front of these trucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, man, you know, this is not going to end well. This is not going to end well.
It doesn't look like it.
Russian forces are not going to just retreat, and the Ukrainian people are not going to back down. There's going to be casualties, and there already are. But the world watches this as the world is. I mean, think about, we watched on CNN the Iraqi war, the beginnings of it. This is like, wait, I mean, we're getting stuff on the ground. We're getting incredible footage. We're getting, the world has completely turned on Russia, completely, and much of Russia has turned on Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, you know, it's a totally silly story. It's hardly a silly topic, and I apologize for this, but when the first Gulf War started, I had my wisdom teeth out that day and was under general anesthetic and got taken back to my apartment. And when I woke up, my TV was flashing green all over the place on a dark screen, and I had no idea. I thought I was being taken up by aliens or something.
Wow!
And that was the day that Bernard Shaw and what was his name were on TV talking about the bombing of Peter, yeah, whatever his name was.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, okay. So, do you feel, because of what's going on, and you know, again, whether Ovechkin is sympathetic or not, I don't know. But what about the other Russian athletes? Do you feel sympathy for other Russian athletes who have nothing to do with what the regime is doing, but are now losing out on opportunities and being cast away from their opportunities as an athlete?
So just because they're hockey players and skilled means they for sure have nothing to do with this Russian war machine?
Didn't say that, but I'm sure, but I would say that a lot of them, I mean, if you're a Russian tennis player or a Russian soccer player,
right,
could you possibly be involved in the regime? I guess so. Is it likely that you're sitting with Putin and coming up with plans to invade Ukraine? More than likely not. You are an athlete and you're not able to do your thing.
Wait, Scott, what do you know about Ovechkin's parents?
Nothing.
Both sides of the family. We don't know. I don't
Nothing.
Know. I have no idea. Is Ovechkin worth a fair bit of money?
Yeah.
You know, does his family have some of that dough in Russia? Oh, I'll bet they do. And so I have no idea. You know, I found out only recently, Scott, and you would enjoy this story too. Only recently did I discover that Epi Guerrero, the late Epi Guerrero, was one of the, you know, the top scout for the Blue Jays. One of the
greatest scout ever, probably.
Greatest ever, right. That his, not on his side of the family, but I believe on his wife's side of the family, she was one of the descendants of Trujillo, the, like the emperor, right? You know, General Trujillo, he ran a government that was, ran fear. He was the dictator, right?
Yeah.
But he was a baseball fan to the point where he had the greatest baseball players in the world. Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, all these great players come and play for his team. And armed guards would circle the stadium. And like, you know, that was pressure to win, right? You know, Satchel Paige kind of told the story. And I found this out and I thought, that's really interesting. Like nobody knew or even dug for that story. You know, he's since passed away and all that. And it really doesn't matter, or does it? But it's interesting to think that, you know, that there was, you know, tremendous influence, like, you know, under like intimidation to win baseball games, to have the best baseball team. I mean, the team's based in Santo Domingo and it's named after you. You're the general, right? You're the leader of the country. So that's a pretty big ego trip. So these guys were under a lot of pressure. So I wonder how much pressure, right? Because of family too, as well. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing.
Maybe Ovechkin's uncle plays tennis with Putin and they're buds.
Could be. And even if he doesn't, I mean, again, I do have some sympathy for Ovechkin in this, and we keep coming back to him mostly because he's probably the biggest name out there, but he does apparently have family back there. And if you speak too loudly and too critically against the guy in charge, who knows what happens to that family? I would be terrified if, what was his name? Who's the guy who plays for the New York Rangers? Panarin, who a year or so ago, there were all kinds of these accusations that were unfounded, apparently, of misbehavior that all of a sudden emerged from Russia when he spoke out. And all of a sudden now they try to ruin his life. So I don't know. It is, it's a really, that is a really tough one to know, you know, to know how much sympathy you're supposed to have. I mean, Dominik Hasek, great all-time great goalie earlier this week or late last week, very outspoken, said the NHL should cancel the contract of every single Russian player and send them home. I don't know what to make. That seems to me to be way over the top, because most of these hockey players who are over here clearly have nothing to do with what's going on, except that they're Russian.
Right, and it's not like we asked them to come over. We signed them to big contracts. We said, come over, bring your family. We'll pay you millions of dollars to be a professional athlete. You can live here. We'll get you your work visa or whatever. You don't have to become a U.S. citizen or that kind of thing. But, it's kind of that age-old question. Like, once you leave a country, do you denounce their citizenship, or can you sit on both sides of the fence? Can you have it both ways? There's a lot of people that feel that, no, you cannot. You're either an American or you're a Russian. And once you become an American, that means you're no longer a Russian. And that means you shouldn't have to worry about those things anymore. But you're not going to be viewed very, very, very fondly back in your home country, because no one likes to hear that someone has denounced their citizenship of the country that they grew up in. It's a slap.
But if you denounce the leader, if you denounce an unpopular leader, you may be just fine. That's the thing. I don't know that Ovechkin should be saying, I hate Russia. I don't think that's the case at all. But if he says, I have problems with Vladimir Putin, I think he comes out on the right side of this. I think he ends up just fine.
Probably. No, I think his family's in incredible danger if he dares.
That, except for that.
That quote goes through Russia like, you know what, through a you know what, a goose.
Except for that, yes.
Wow.
Yes. Hey, before we go, Mark, before we go, I got to ask you, because you mentioned the Klitschkos again, and I'm just amazed by what they're doing, but not just the Klitschkos. And this is not really a sports question per se, but you bring up the Klitschkos, two guys who I don't recall if they ever did military duty before. I don't know if they have any military background whatsoever, but so many people in Ukraine who have no military background are grabbing a gun and fighting. If this was to happen here, do you think the same thing would happen? Do you think we'd have hundreds of thousands of Canadians who would be voluntarily grabbing guns and going to the front lines? Or do you think we'd be having a different response? I've been thinking about that a lot the last few days.
Scott, I believe that if we had had a skirmish with the United States over the years leading up to today, where there were, fears of crossing into borders that one might invade the other, where, there was some political discourse, then I would say, yeah. But, we know nothing but freedom, basically, with our U.S. neighbors. There's never, never in our lifetime or any of our ancestors, for that matter, as far as I can tell, there's ever been a beef. And so, Canadians' dislike for Americans comes from, American media and, the one American they might have met that's the ugly American, something like that. And, of course, same is true with Americans. But I think beyond that, no, Canadians aren't used to, be prepared to take up arms. We're not used to that. I think in Ukraine, they're used to it. I think in Israel, they're used to it. I think in any country that's had, a history with their neighboring country, with wars, skirmishes, breakouts, whatever, and a military presence, then that's different. But I'll be honest, I can't believe I've ever seen a U.S. soldier in person. No, I don't believe I have.
I would love to believe that if such a thing were to happen, if Russia was to decide to aim at us or something, that we would do the same here in Canada. And I would love to believe that. I hope that would be the case, but I've been thinking about that a lot the last few days. What would we do if we were in the exact same situation? It's something to talk about over a coffee. Thankfully we can do it in peace here. Mark Hebscher, always love having you on. People, go check out Hebsy on Sports. Again, you can find it wherever you find podcasts. It's a great show that he does. Really appreciate the time, Mark. Thanks for this.
Scott, thanks. It's, by the way, Hebsy.online is the new website. And there's a pictorial history of me. I found a whole bunch of pictures.
Is that right? Like fully clothed?
Pardon me?
All fully clothed. The pictorial history. Yes.
Yeah. There might be one where I might be topless, but I was pretty young there. Hebsy.online. So thanks for this. Thanks as always. And all the best to you and all the listeners and all my friends in Hamilton.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.